Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Each week, Inside Education brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney and you can listen to or download hundreds of podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education from seandelaney.com/podcasts. My guest on the programme this week, Pam Grossman, was a guest on Inside Education over 5 years ago. At that time, Professor Pam Grossman was on the faculty of Stanford University in the United States. In 2015, she moved east and she is now Dean of the School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. Throughout her career, she has been interested in promoting excellence in teaching and especially in supporting beginning teachers who are working in underserved schools. Her own background is in teaching English to post-primary school students, and she is interested in the knowledge teachers need in order to teach. She was recently a keynote speaker at the annual conference of the Association for Teacher Education in Europe in Eindhoven, in the Netherlands, and that is where I met up with her. Her keynote presentation was about practice-based teacher education, and I began the conversation afterwards by asking her to summarise the main message she wanted to convey to those who attended her keynote presentation.
My effort in this talk was to take a step back and look at the work around core practices as the basis for practice-based teacher education, and to look at some of the challenges facing that effort, and then to also highlight the work of the Core Practice Consortium, which is a group of teacher educators and researchers on teacher education that are in the midst of addressing some of those challenges. As I titled the talk, we're in the midst of a turn towards practice, but that means many different things to many different people. And so partly trying to bring some clarity to the different varieties of practice-based teacher education, and then dig a little deeper into practice-based teacher education that's organized around core practices.
And when you use the word practice, what do you mean by it?
My definition of practice is actually quite broad and informed by sociocultural theory that doesn't try to separate out knowledge and skill, but in fact sees practice as the compilation of the knowledge, understanding, judgment, and skill, and identity of, in this case, teachers who are doing the work. Practice is goal-directed activity, so the purposes of the activity are part of that definition of practice as well.
So it's different, say, from what we would have called teaching practice, for example, or doing something repeatedly in order to get good at it.
Yes, it's much closer to the idea of entering a practice, entering professional practice, which includes, in that sense, the knowledge and skill that you need, as well as the sense of a community of practice, that when you enter medical practice, it's not the sense that you have individual practice that doesn't resemble the practice of other practitioners, but rather you're entering a community that has a defined repertoire in some ways of practices, a common body of knowledge, some set and expectations for what good practice looks like. So it's much closer to that idea of practice.
When you brought it up with the teacher educators and everyone who was present this morning, you particularly described it in terms of its relevance to teacher education and to beginning teacher education. But when I think of, say, something like a medical practice or an architectural practice or a dental practice, I think it has implications for practitioners in the field as well, in that one of the things in any of those practices I've mentioned is checking with one another about, you know, what would you do in this situation, or, you know, how would you deal with this particular situation. That doesn't tend to happen among teachers to the same extent, or does it?
Well, I think it does, actually. I think teachers learn a great deal from one another. And I think they often will say that their biggest source of growth is their colleagues. So I think that is a very important shared body of knowledge. I think what's different in teaching is that in medical practice, you're not expected to make it up. As a matter of fact, you would be a little worried about that, that there is a research base that people would consult. There are protocols of practice that you would expect to try first before, you know, sometimes you had to improvise. So there's a more settled body of practice that you would draw from. I think in teaching, there has been more of a culture of an individualistic culture of each person invents practice on their own. And that's also true for teacher education, by the way. So part of what this effort has been is, can we begin to develop some common understandings of practice and more commonality in how we can describe that work, which would really improve the quality of that consultation when teachers ask. Because one of the things we found, and we've used core practices in the development of professional development for experienced teachers, and we worked with departments and introduced a set of core practices that we were working on together. And one of the things they told us, that what was so enormously useful, and this was an observation protocol, was having common language to describe those practices and a common idea of what that practice looked like. Right? So when you're trying to get advice from everybody, people, at least you have the same idea of where you're headed.
You mentioned your cross-professional work. That's one of the things that you would be known for in Ireland, and particularly how you notice that in other professions like psychologists and like clergy, they have this model where practice is represented, mm-hmm. and then it's decomposed and it's approximated before they're ready for individual practice or for solo right. practice or practice in a professional place. That has been a very popular idea in teacher education. What do you make of how people have taken on board what you proposed there?
Well, it's very exciting, actually. When you write something, you never know what kind of impact it will have, if people will pay attention, what they'll take from it, if they take the things you're hoping they'll take from it. And I think this is a case in which the ways in which people have built on this notion of representations, decompositions, and approximations has been very generative. I think the development of rehearsals as a pedagogy and the way that people have begun to sort of think about the ways in which rehearsal is a form of approximation and what it affords beginning teachers. So I've actually been very pleased with how the idea has been taken up. I mean, teacher education did some of that and has a history. For example, micro-teaching is an example of where teacher education really invested in approximate a particular approximation of practice. So I think that's been, again, in this turn towards practice-based teacher education, that's probably been one of the most generative ideas.
And how exactly do you see the difference between what you are proposing and, say, something like micro-teaching?
I think that micro-teaching is one form of approximation of practice. One thing I like about micro-teaching is that it was programmatic research on that particular approximation. So if you go back, and I review this literature in my book on the pedagogy of teacher education, there's actually quite a bit of research looking at the role of feedback, for example, in micro-teaching, and who gives the feedback and how useful that feedback is, the nature of what people are practicing in that. They really dug into that and learned a lot. So I would love us, and I think we're beginning to do the same thing right now with rehearsals, of really developing programmatic research that both looks at those different forms and then comparative research that compares what you get out of an approximation to what you learn in the field. So we begin to, again, build a more robust body of knowledge about what it means to learn to teach.
And isn't the problem going to be that you can never really compare how people learn to teach from using this approach as opposed to another approach? Because once you go down a particular route, you've gone down that route and you can't unlearn what you've learned in that particular way. Is that a challenge for you in terms of, you know, understanding what contribution it's making to teacher education?
Well, I think actually we could do much more quasi-experimental research, where we begin, and I think there are some places that are trying to do this, where you actually have people who have common coursework, but then you diverge the nature of the practice-based opportunities, the approximations, and some people are learning in the context of the just working with the cooperating teachers. Other people have very sustained work around these approximations of practice, and then look where they are in terms of that practice, you know, at different points in time. So I actually am more optimistic than you are that we could disentangle some of that and learn about that.
Are there any particular ways that the framework of the representations, decompositions, and approximations have been interpreted that have kind of, you've kind of thought, oh, that's a very interesting interpretation, or, you know, what have you heard about it that's being applied in the field?
So as I said, in most cases, it does feel like it is close to some of those ideas. I think it's more the way in which the core practice work has been taken up that I sometimes worry about. And I was very clear in this morning's talk that what we don't mean is a checklist of competencies. But I think sometimes people hear core practices or teacher education organized around core practices, and that's what's in their mind. I'm working very hard to try to dislodge that idea. And maybe that's where the work on micro-teaching, the kinds of things people were practicing were really quite small. They were of a small grain size, closer to techniques. So wait time, for example, is a good example. I don't call that a practice. I think it is a technique in a facilitating classroom discourse, right? So practicing wait time is different than practicing the practice of facilitating classroom discourse, which has more of those features of practice that I talked about earlier.
So if you were to say what the difference is then between a competence and a core practice, how would you differentiate those terms?
Because we're returning to the notion of competencies, it really is important to clarify this. So often the competencies in competency-based teacher education were at the grain size of techniques. They were techniques that teachers could enact, and you could check them off in a checklist. And the expectation is they were always present, right? Core practices are ones that become part of the teacher's toolbox that are at a larger grain size that encompass a set of techniques, but again are goal-directed, that you're doing those things for a particular purpose around student learning. So again, facilitating classroom discussion would be an example. It encompasses a lot of different techniques, but the goals are really to help students construct meaning through discourse, through listening to one another and building on one another's ideas. And you want to keep that goal in mind as you're practicing the different components of it.
So the goal then is the really central part.
The goal and I think the grain size, those are the two things. So the grain size of what we often think of as competencies is a much smaller grain size.
Because the way you got into, one of the ways you got into all of this was your initial interest in the teaching of English.
Yeah.
And what do you like to see in a good English lesson?
So, and in fact, I developed an observation protocol,
Plato,
that helps us, think about what are the practices that you would expect to see. And then we did some empirical work on the extent to which they were associated with student learning. Again, partly what I do like to see is students participating in the lessons in a variety of ways, primarily through discourse. The high quality classroom discussion where kids are helping to generate the ideas and responding to one another ideas and building on that is part of what I would expect to see, particularly in discussions of literature. I mean, that seems to me a signature pedagogy of the English classroom. A second point is around the intellectual challenge of a classroom. So one of the questions I ask when I go to visit a classroom is, who's doing the intellectual work in the class? Is it the teacher or the students? And often you see a very high level of intellectual challenge, but the teacher's doing all the work, right? When you look at what the students are doing, they're copying things down. That's a low level of intellectual challenge. So that question of how intellectually challenging is the activity in the classroom and who's doing the work. A third piece, because the teaching of writing is such a primary part of English classrooms, is to think through kind of how are students learning to write and being encouraged to write. So are they producing texts in the classroom? And what's the nature of those texts? Are they being asked to just fill in lines? Or are they really being asked to write extended prose? So looking at the quality of students' work is an important thing in looking in an English classroom. Similarly, how are teachers teaching the kinds of strategies that students need both to read and write complex texts? So one of the things we find in the States is we're quite good at teaching decoding, right? But not very good at teaching comprehension, much less interpretation, right? And yet I would see in secondary classrooms, I would want to see all of those. And so how are teachers actually helping students learn how you analyze a piece of literature? How you begin to generate an interpretation, what makes for a good interpretation. And that involves a fair amount of strategy instruction and modeling modeling of cognition. So how do you model kind of the interpretive process for kids and then provide them lots of opportunities to do that work themselves?
And what would you say to a teacher who's looking for guidance on what kind of literary texts to select in terms of contemporary versus classical versus representing diversity and so on in the classroom? How can teachers make those kinds of decisions?
Well, first of all, I'd say all of them. I mean, what I would like to see is, and again, it's a little bit like nutrition, everything in moderation, that you would want to see a classroom in which teachers were able to put texts into dialogue with one another. So one of my favorite units is where you pair the Great Gatsby, which is a classic American text, with Jasmine, which is a text about an Indian woman coming to America and reinventing herself. Both of them are centrally about this American idea that you can reinvent yourself. It's a very American idea. Come to America, you know. And in Jasmine, she goes through three different names. She moves to three different cities. You see very much. So these two characters are very much in conversation with one another around this theme of the American dream and the reinvention of the self. And I think the texts become much richer when they're put into conversation with each other. So similarly, King Lear and Jane Smiley's text, 1,000 Acres, you know, they're... 1,000 Acres in some ways is a retelling of King Lear, but in a contemporary context. So when you put those into conversation with one another, I think the text becomes so much richer. So I think it's really a question of how do you select texts that will engage students and be very interesting, but also prepare them with some of the texts that are, again, central to kind of a developing an idea of genre or of literature. How do you put those? So when we taught a course in adolescent literature, for example, we would sort of look at a classic text like Catcher in the Rye, which is not young adult literature, and then Harry Potter, which is not considered young adult literature. It's considered children's literature. And then begin to read a variety of young adult texts and say, well, how do we constitute the genre? What are the rules of this particular genre?
And that's what you would do with your student teachers?
I've done that with undergraduates. Okay. You could do that with students, K-12 students as well.
You mentioned there the observation record or protocol that you developed, Plato. And I just wonder, why do we need instruments for evaluating teachers and for observing teachers?
So first, I want to be clear that we developed Plato as a research tool, not as an evaluation tool, and it's actually never been used for teacher evaluation in any meaningful context. The reason you need observation protocols, though, for research purposes and for evaluation purposes, is you need a common set of things you're looking at. If you're going to compare across classrooms, you need to know that the observers are looking for similar things. And the observation protocols help to standardize vision, professional vision. I would say actually that the process of developing one of these instruments also helps you really, again, think through what are the core practices, what are the things that are most important. So it becomes a very helpful activity, I think. It's a great resource in many ways when you train people in an observation protocol because they begin to develop a more common understanding of what does high quality practice look like and how can I describe it using these indicators that are in the protocol. And it becomes, in that sense, a language of practice. So my sense is, although we developed initially for a research study that was trying to look across the classrooms of hundreds of teachers, so we needed to, again, know that people were looking. You could imagine trying to do that from qualitative notes and then coding all those notes. I mean, it's just very, very time consuming. Yeah. So this, in some ways, does the first level of data reduction for you. But then I think, you know, I'm much more interested in the use of these observation protocols for the development of teaching in many ways than for evaluation, because I really do think the whole purpose of evaluation is for improvement. So again, if you think of these observation tools as a common language of practice, as providing a set of core practices, and then helping people improve wherever they are, wherever they start. This should be like yoga teaching. Wherever you are, you can get better, right? And yoga teachers are brilliant. You know, no matter if you can't touch, you know, your knees, they'll say, that's where you're starting, and you're going to get better from there. So in a sense, these protocols give you a snapshot of where you are. And because they're multidimensional, it's not you're a good teacher, you're a bad teacher. It's like you're really great at managing a classroom. You really, you know, you have the kids with you, you're excellent in that, but the kids aren't talking. So let's focus on how to improve the quality of classroom discourse. That's the other important thing about these, is that they're not holistic. They really are saying these are different elements of teaching, and people can be strong in some and less strong in others. And so how do you use it diagnostically to say this is an area where we can really help you improve?
So the focus is on the teaching rather than the teacher. Is
yeah,
that right?
Exactly. The focus is much more on the teaching than on the individual teacher, because as I said, the individual teacher has strengths and weaknesses that vary depending on this set of practices. And when we show videotapes to teachers to help them, again, improve, we say focus less on this is a good teacher or a bad teacher. Focus more on, again, how the quality of their modeling. And we deliberately show them a really great teacher who is very strong in some practices and not as strong in others. So they see even within an individual teacher, it varies.
And supposing, though, you are in the situation where you have to decide whether somebody is actually fit for practice as a teacher. Now, whether you're using an observation protocol or whatever way you're making the decision, you have to make a decision. And I know this is a very difficult question, but where can you set a minimum to say, okay, well, you have to at least be able to do this, this, and this in order to show that you have potential to develop as a teacher?
Yeah, I think that's actually critically important work, both for pre-service teacher education and then at the tenure decision when teachers are getting tenure, that we should be able to make some determinations of are they skillful enough to, again, be a well-started beginner. They're not going to be an expert teacher yet, but at least they are well-prepared to continue to grow, and we ensure they don't do harm to kids. So, and I think that we know enough about certain practices and how they relate to student achievement that we can begin to make some of those determinations. So Teaching Works, of course, at the University of Michigan is developing some assessments of some of these core practices. My sense, even without a set of tools, when I was a teacher educator, there were certain things I would look for. One is the quality of their subject matter knowledge, because again, you don't get a lot more time to develop that. So if there were people who really just felt so shaky in the very thing they were supposed to be teaching students, that's one of the questions you would have. Another is looking at the work on verbal ability and student achievement. So where students have an extraordinarily difficult time providing instructional explanations. There's something called a verbal fugue, and there was research that showed that verbal fugues were highly correlated with negative student achievement, where you just can't follow the person. You probably know when you've heard one. you lose track of where they're going. If somebody can't improve the quality of their verbal explanations, that's probably a real danger sign for
Who
teaching.
Who came up with that term, the verbal
That's
fugue?
Actually from the 70s, and there was a body of research on that. Okay. So, I think that part of where we're headed with research is, you know, we want to believe that all people can learn, but that doesn't mean that everybody can teach and everybody can be a good teacher. And we want to work with people who have promise and get them as far as they can. But at certain points along the way, you say, maybe this isn't the right profession for you.
And I know a lot of your observation of teachers has been done as a researcher. But if we think of, say, at the professional level, who do you think is best placed to observe and to evaluate teachers? And I'm particularly thinking here of the Irish situation, where we have inspectors currently doing it, but there are talks that it may actually be principals. And do you have a view on, you know, who is in a good position to actually evaluate teachers?
So I think, from my perspective, first of all, for secondary teachers, it's very important that the person who's observing has some subject expertise. So I think it's very hard for a kindergarten teacher to go in and observe a secondary physics teacher and provide either useful feedback or a sense of whether or not they're effective. You wouldn't want me evaluating a physics teacher. I could give you a very minimal level of, is the classroom organized? But you wouldn't want to count on me to know whether or not the content's correct. So I think it's very important that we think through the kind of subject matter and grade level expertise we have for the particular high stakes evaluation of teachers. I think We are too quick to say anybody could evaluate teaching. For Plato, we require people have teaching experience and ELA experience before we'll certify them on Plato.
ELA being English Language Arts. That they've been teaching that subject.
Yeah. Yes, because we do think that understanding what high-quality modeling looks like, you actually do need to understand what's being modeled, the content, and have some understanding of classrooms and how classrooms work. So I actually think whoever evaluates teachers does need to have that kind of experience. In terms of secondary teaching, again, I think we could use teachers more than we do. So the role of department chair, for example, used to be a role where that person was expected to have greater expertise around the teaching of the subject matter and was somebody who was responsible for the professional development of the teachers in that department. And you might imagine that in teacher evaluation involved the principal, it could be a combination of the principal and department chair. The principal has more local knowledge of the students and than maybe an inspector might coming from the outside, but may not have the subject matter. So you, and now I'm going to a triumvirate, you might imagine an inspector, a department chair, and a principal, if you had three vantage points on a classroom, you would probably have the highest quality evaluation. Because in some ways, if you're in a school and you haven't observed a lot of classrooms elsewhere, you might have the bar set too low or too high. Somebody who has a lot of experience across classrooms could come in and say, actually, they look pretty good.
Because it can be difficult enough to combine the role of mentor on the one hand, if, for example, you're a department chair where you may be engaged in mentoring, and to then turn around and evaluate.
Right.
That can be tricky.
I think that's one of the reasons why they've often tried to separate those two roles. But if you thought of part of their feedback went into the overall evaluation, similarly, principals have felt they couldn't be mentors because they were the evaluator. But if you see that, again, these ratings are all combined, that it's not a single individual, and that their role is both to help people get better as well as provide a summative score, you might imagine that. One of the studies in the States found, at least in terms of principals' ability to identify teachers who scored very low or very high on value added, they were actually pretty good at it. They could identify the people who were really low and really high. They weren't very good at distinguishing the middle, but guess what? Neither is value added. So value added scores are the method of teacher evaluation that looks at the impact of students, teachers on students' growth.
And that would be their test scores, standardized tests.
Yeah, all based on standardized tests.
A comprehensive answer there to the question about teacher education from Professor Pam Grossman, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. I want to thank Pam for her time in doing the interview. My own new book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is now available, and I'll be featuring it on a future programme. You can listen to or download podcasts of all previous Inside Education programmes on seandelaney.com/podcasts. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.